there were a few people, some within the museum and some without, that said, oh, you over-restored it, you over-polished it, it's too shiny. When we completed the restoration, General Tibbetts came to visit, and one of us took the advantage of the situation and said, General Tibbetts, was it that shiny when you flew it? And he said, oh, yeah. And we said, oh, yeah, now we've got everybody. There is no higher authority than that on that subject.
That's Ann McCombs of the National Air and Space Museum speaking about the enormous effort to restore the famed World War II B-29, the Enola Gay. The Enola Gay can be seen in what is certainly one of the world's premier aviation museums, the Udvar Hazy Center, near Dulles Airport in Virginia. The airplane popped up on our radar recently when the Smithsonian Network sent us a new DVD on the museum called America's Hangar. It started airing in March of 2009. The segment on the Enola Gay got us wondering about what it took to restore the airplane. We interviewed Ann McCombs and Bob McLean, both of whom took part in the nearly 20-year restoration project. Here's Ann McCombs on how the airplane came to the Air and Space Museum in the first place.
After the airplane flew the Hiroshima mission, for which it is known, as most people know, it was taken to the Bikini Atoll tests. It was not used, but it was present for that, and it then returned to the U.S. The decision was made in 1946, apparently by the Air Force or Army Air Force, that it was going to be preserved. So that happened very early in its career. The title was transferred to the Smithsonian in 1946, and it was formally presented to us in 1949. It was flown by Tibbetts to the Orchard Place Airfield, which is now O'Hare, and presented formally at that time. Its last flight was into the Andrews Air Force Base in 1953, and it sat there until 1960, when disassembly commenced by our predecessors, and was actually moved to Garber facility for storage and subsequent restoration in 1961.
Was it in viewable storage during that period?
Now, one of our directors decided to make it a place where people can come with a special tour and look at some of the airplanes we have in storage. And during some of that time, you could go into our Building 22 and see the Enola Gay in the corner, front fuselage separated from the rear. And I remember seeing it as a tourist coming on one of these tours in the early 80s.
And what was the condition of the airplane when it arrived at Silver Hill? And I guess I should say Silver Hill is the old name for what is now known as the Paul E. Garber facility.
After hearing the variety of places that it was stored, most of them outside, we found the airplane was corroded like you'd expect an aluminum airplane to be corroded. It had some problem with bird dropping. I found sand in some of the places from desert storage, and the airplane obviously carried the sand from the desert up to other more humid places, and that created some problems with corrosion in confined places, the moisture collecting in the sand and then corroding. Overall, it wasn't in terrible condition. It just was weathered, I guess you would say, with the addition of the bird droppings.
Was the airframe complete with all of the equipment that was involved in the dropping of the first atomic bomb?
The airplane had a few other pieces of equipment added to it after the Hiroshima mission. They had intended to use it at the Bikini test and had re-outfitted it to some degree. So I can't say it was exactly in the condition that it was after it had completed its Hiroshima mission. Also that we replicated a bomb rack for it, a bomb rack specific to the little boy. We may now have the original bomb rack, and it may actually be installed in there. I don't recall, but I do remember early efforts to make it more complete by outfitting the bomb bay that way. And, of course, there are consumables in an airplane, like airplane fabric and even the engines that were on the airplane. I don't believe are the actual engines that flew the mission. They were engines that were swapped out for some of the ferry flights to bring the airplane back here.
So the engines that the airplane currently has on display came from somewhere else, and I'm sure they're not airworthy engines, but what kind of condition are they in?
two of the engines were that came to us with the airframe were sent to San Diego for restoration, and two of them were restored here in our shop. Our objective is to make them last as long as possible, and not especially to make them airworthy. So if we have a choice between preserving some original corroded or slightly corroded piece of material that was with the engine originally, or replacing it with a new, updated, or pristine piece, we'll generally go with the older piece to keep it more original and more complete, at least to what it was when we received it.
We look at this airplane now and as it's displayed. Do you think it looks more like it did as it came out of the factory or more like it did after the mission?
I'd say it looks essentially as it did when it came off the mission. The main thing that a person would be able to notice looking at it is, of course, when they flew the mission, they were wearing seat-packed parachutes, and the seats are cupped in order to accommodate the seat-packed parachutes, and they're horrendously uncomfortable to sit in unless you have some kind of a cushion. And from time to time, when General Tibbetts was alive, he would ask to revisit the airplane and take his seat in the airplane's cockpit. And because of that, we fitted some simple but reasonably comfortable cushions that we've just left in the airplane. So you can see those. If you know to look for them, they strike a false note. But other than that, the cockpit is pretty close to what it would have looked like when it flew the Hiroshima mission.
Did he visit it when it was at Silver Hill?
Yes, he did. Several occasions. He was always extremely gracious and appreciative to the restoration staff for their efforts in preserving the airplane.
What is the overall goal of a restoration like this? Obviously, airworthiness isn't a concern, but what guides the decision-making? What determines what gets done and what doesn't get done?
As Bob was mentioning, we're interested in preservation. We're interested in longevity. Those two goals sometimes conflict with each other, and sometimes you can get some pretty good debates going in the shop about the best approach to things. As you note, airworthiness is completely off the page as far as our considerations. The example I like to use are the hoses. Now, as you might imagine, the oil lines, for example, on Enola Gay, they're 60 years old. They're not airworthy. They're very hard. They're very stubborn to get on and off their fittings. We reused them when we could. If we possibly could get them off, and sometimes it took extreme measures to coax them off, we would do so. If they crumbled to dust in our hands, then we would replace them.
Are all the parts and pieces present and accounted for in some way, even ones that you can't see?
I'd say generally the answer to your question is yes. We went to great lengths to restore and outfit the inside of the airplane to the best of our ability, to the way it was or the way perhaps it should have been at the time that it flew its famous mission. Not just an empty shell that's been polished on the outside. It's a restoration through and through.
What about items like checklists and things that relate to the operation of the airplane? Are they to be found in the restoration as well?
We tend to separate paper records that are in an aircraft from the aircraft and put them in a curator's file or some sort of an archival file. I would guess those kinds of materials would end up in a curator's file where they could be studied after the aircraft goes on display.
What would you describe as one of or some of the bigger challenges of restoring this airplane that may have been more difficult than you imagined?
To me, the largest challenge is the sheer size of the airplane and the number of parts and sub-assemblies and components that we had to pay attention to. Corrosion on the airplane wasn't really outstanding compared to other projects we've worked on. The airplane was more or less intact. It had not been damaged or destroyed in many ways. So from that point of view, it was a pretty straightforward restoration. I would describe it as the largest full restoration that the Air and Space Museum has ever taken on.
Well, as Bob noted, one of the big challenges is just the sheer size of it. One of our colleagues, Carl Heinzel, who has since retired, said once, if you think about restoring an OLED gate, you can't do it. If you look at it as a great big aluminum tube full of a whole bunch of small projects, then it's approachable. And that was one of the things. For example, I spent the majority of about 2 years doing nothing but polishing the skin. And that, just from the sheer tedium standpoint, is challenging, just to come in day after day after day, because it's a dirty, physically demanding job, and polishing things such as the underside of the wing, and you can't turn that wing over, was just hard to face. Not that it was difficult to figure out how to do it, it was just very tedious. As far as the part of the job that we all looked at it and were simply terrified at how difficult it was going to be and the consequences if it went wrong, I would say it was fitting the wings onto the fuselage. On a B-29, the inboard wings meet each other and are joined at the center line, and then that assembly is lowered into the fuselage from above. Very massive assemblies, fairly tight fits. We were absolutely terrified, and we had a rented crane and operator to do it. It went very smoothly, but that was because a lot of people had sweated very much over the details to make sure that it would go together.
You said you polished the airplane. How did you do that? And did you end up doing every square inch of it?
I personally did not. I think practically everyone in the museum polished on it at one time or another. It was so demanding and it's so large that everyone in the shop certainly polished on it. We had volunteers. We had interns. We put out the pitch for more help. We had people from downtown. We had curators polishing on it. We did stop short of grabbing people off the tour and saying, this is your moment in history. But anyone we could get to help polish it, we did have help. And it was a huge job. We mostly used mildly abrasive pads, a special polish that was formulated for us specifically for that job, and handheld actually, most of them were dual-action sanders that were fit with a special pad.
And once polished, how is it kept bright?
Mostly the fact that nobody can touch it. Certainly it is probably dulling as we speak. Everything does eventually. Rust always wins over the long haul. But the fact that nobody can touch it means that you don't look at it and see that that's a problem. Sooner or later, we'll have to address that, and it won't be fun. With regard to polishing, once we got it together, there were a few people, some within the museum and some without, that said, oh, you over-restored it, you over-polished it, it's too shiny. And we had photographs showing that, let's face it, it was a new airplane in 1945. It was a nice, shiny airplane, but people said that. And when we completed the restoration, General Tibbets came to visit, and one of us took the advantage of the situation and said, General Tibbets, was it that shiny when you flew it? And he said, oh, yeah. And we said, oh, yeah, now we've got everybody. There is no higher authority than that on that subject.
Given the complexity of the B-29, what did you do for technical reference and documentation? Obviously, this material is no longer available from the manufacturer.
Frequently here at the Garber facility, we end up restoring airplanes that we have no documentation for. But in this case, we were extremely lucky in that the B-29 is well represented in our archival technical files. And I'd venture to say that we had, except for some of the special radio applications and things, we had complete documentation on the airplane. And it was, from that point of view, it was a very easy project.
There were a few things that were issues because they were different because of it being a silver plate airplane or because our documentation didn't happen to cover that exact model. The one that I worked on that I remember having a lot of trouble with was the crew oxygen supply, which is very complex in a B-29, and I had a lot of difficulty with that because it was not exactly the way our manuals said it would be.
The fact that it was a silver plate airplane, does that mean some things were top secret and not documented?
The main thing was the bomb rack, and that, the story has been told, and this is secondhand, that the only thing we really had to work from at the time was a couple of photographs that they had gotten declassified, because even the bomb rack itself was classified at the time. At this point, I'd say it's probably pretty accurate. The other thing that's noteworthy about a silver-plate airplane is it has far fewer guns. The only guns it has are the two in the tail.
Mm-hmm. It also had a different kind of propeller on it. It had a Curtiss electric propeller versus a Hamilton standard hydromatic propeller.
And how about the display in the museum? I understand quite a lot of care went into the design of the way the airplane is displayed.
The main thing that was a consideration that's unusual about it, anyone who's seen it at the Hazy Center knows that it's raised up on three large platforms that raise it above the floor, and that was primarily done in order to clear up floor space for other airplanes to be exhibited under it. It does have additional benefit of giving the visitor a really splendid view of the cockpit from the mezzanine that crosses right in front of it.
From start to finish, how long did the restoration take?
The restoration began, and we have an exact date on that, on the 5th of December in 1984. That's when it was brought into the shop and the first logbook by the first restorer begins. And it really was not completed when it first went on display downtown back in the mid-90s. We'd have to say that it was essentially complete when it was presented to the media in a preview opening on August 18th of 2003. That was before the Udvar-Hazy Center opened to the public, but they had a preview opening for the media, and the airplane was essentially complete at that time. We had one guy that was continuing to track down small details regarding the avionics up until he retired, and that was this year.
So really, it's more than a 20-year restoration project.
Yeah, the bulk of it took on the order of a little more than 10 years. But the final assembly, of course, between the time that it went on exhibit downtown, which is in mid-95, and when we moved it out to the Hazy Center, there wasn't a lot of activity going on with it. There was some. But you really have to say that it was assembled and ready to be shown in August of 2003.
So let's see, 20 years worth of restoration work. What stands out the most about this project?
I'd have to say that it was the realization of how difficult it would be to put such an airplane together, design, construction, production. I think they were turning these out maybe at a rate of one a day, as I understand it. Again, I'm not a historian, but to a lone person looking at the object, it just seems impossible and amazing. And that kind of came back as something I thought about again and again and again during the restoration.
You can see the restored Enola Gay at the Air and Space Museum's Udvar-Hazy Center in Chantilly, Virginia. Learn more about the center at nasm.si.edu. I'm Paul Bertarelli, reporting for AvWeb. Thanks for listening.